okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, let me know when you want.
Yeah, I think, ready.
Hello, good, ooh, sorry. Well, I hope that got everyone's attention. Good morning, and we're gonna start this panel. My name is Patrick Bumate from the U.S. Court of Appeals from the Ninth Circuit. Before beginning, I want to say what an honor it is to be moderating this panel. I attended my first student symposium almost 20 years ago when it was at Vanderbilt Law School in 2004. I actually remember it quite distinctly because my flight back was canceled and I was stranded at the Nashville airport for hours. So hopefully my flight home will be more uneventful today. It's a wonderful opportunity to be moderating this panel. And it is an interesting topic too. It's called Unique Aspects of American Democracy, Structural Bugs or Features. It's quite a broad topic, but I think it's an important question in constitutional law. It reminds me of a passage in Justice Gorsuch's book, A Republic If You Can Keep It. He writes that in any country can have a Bill of Rights. Any country can say that it protects free exercise or due process. Heck, even North Korea's constitution says that there's freedom of speech, press, and association. But the radical innovation of the American constitution was a separation of powers. It's a structural separation of powers that truly protects our liberty. So one of my favorite questions when I do clerkship interviews is, articles or amendments? Meaning, is it the Constitution's articles that are more important, or is it the enumeration of rights in the amendments that are more important? And insider tip, if you ever interview me, the answer to me is articles. So now I'll introduce our panelists. Our first speaker is Professor Bradley Smith of Capital University Law School. Professor Smith was the former chairman of the Federal Election Commission. Next, we'll have Professor Lori Ringhand of the University of Georgia. Professor Ringhand teaches constitutional law, election law, and state and local government law. Next, we'll have hometown professor Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas. As the local students know, Professor Levinson has authored 6 books on the Constitution, with his most recent being Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Lastly, we'll have Professor Stephanie Barclay of Notre Dame. Professor Barclay is an expert on religious exercise. She runs the Notre Dame Religious Liberty Clinic, and in fact, I've seen a lot of her briefs in my court, so that's keep them coming. And so before we get to the Q&A, each panelist will give their opening statements. Professor Smith, do you want to get us started?
Thank you, Judge, and thank the panelists. Thank you all for coming. I just want to say that last panel was great. I loved it. I hope you were here for it, in part because I want to start by noting that the Supreme Court heard argument in Moore v. Harper, which was talked about a lot during the last panel. For those of you who were playing hooky or still getting over last night's festivities or something at that time, in a nutshell, the case is about the independent state legislature doctrine, which holds that, again, very kind of brief summary, that the U.S. Constitution grants powers to state legislatures, or that when it does so, it means that any action taken by those legislatures is immune from judicial review under state constitutions. The immediate question in the case is whether or not North Carolina's congressional district should be drawn by the state legislature or by the state Supreme Court. Now, the reactions to this case have been very, very strong. Some were noted in the last session. According to the Democrats' go-to Washington think tank, the Center for American Progress, a ruling for the legislature in this case will, quote, harm democracy. The American Civil Liberties Union says it will upend democracy. The Atlantic prefers to say it will derail democracy. And Common Cause says that this is the most serious legal threat to democracy that we have ever faced. Now, this kind of reaction strikes me as strange because the question is, should the districts be drawn by the elected legislature or decided by judges? And even recognizing that in North Carolina they elect their judges, the decision of the court would apply to many states where judges are not elected but are unelected officials. And so it strikes me as an odd thing to criticize the decision or the potential decision that is feared as being anti-democratic. Similarly, and I'll just use one other example here. I could use many others, but I'll just take this one very prominent. It was last year's Supreme Court decision in the Dobbs case. Returning the question of abortion to elected state lawmakers was said by the Washington Post to, quote, degrade democracy. Taking it away from the courts and giving it to the voters was said by Yale Law's distinguished professor Reva Siegel that it makes our constitutional order less democratic. And a group, which I hadn't heard of, but I like it because it's really fits, called Democracy Erosion, says that the Dobbs decision, naturally, quote, erodes democracy. And the group goes further. Democracy, says Democracy Erosion, quote, is the protection of rights and freedoms. Well, no, that's not what democracy is. Democracy is not the protection of rights and freedoms. Democracy is one tool that can be used to protect rights and freedoms, and the Supreme Court often talks about it in those terms, talking about it as being the most important civil right because it's protective of all rights, and in certain circumstances that may be true. And most of us recognize that voting and democracy is a hugely important part of our constitutional system. It should not be downplayed. But at the same time, most of us also recognize, if we think about it, that in a majority rules democracy, democracy can also be used to destroy our rights or to rob us of our rights. Now, thus we have a constitutional system which is not built around democracy, but is a mixture of both democratic and non-democratic features, or one could even say counter-democratic features, elements. And this is intended to ensure, I think, two primary goals. One, to provide for good government for the whole of the country, for the whole of the people. And secondly, to protect individual liberties, which was generally viewed as being integral to that first objective, providing good government. Hence, I submit that when modern progressives, and it tends to be progressives, complain that some feature of our constitutional system is a threat to democracy or something somebody's doing, whether it's the Electoral College or the U.S. Senate or the fact that each state gets at least one congressional representative and so on, what they really mean is that in the immediate circumstances, they're either unhappy with the mix of democratic and non-democratic features in the Constitution, or that the non-democratic features are standing in the way, or maybe even the democratic features are standing in the way of achieving immediate short-term progressive political goals. But they can't say this, because to say that they're just unhappy with the mix of democratic and non-democratic elements, or to say that democratic elements are standing in the way of their goals, such as returning Dobbs to the voters, would destroy a rhetorical tactic that they have used very effectively to attack other parts of the constitutional system that stand in the way of some of their short-term political goals as they see it. They may be incorrect on these things. It's amazing how often people are incorrect in predicting consequences. But and that would be things like the Electoral College and so on, that they want to attack as non-democratic. And to admit that our system actually includes both democratic and non-democratic elements would take some of the teeth out of this rhetorical attack. Now, the second point I want to make is that whether something is called more democratic or not may in many cases depend on where and when, at what level we think the decision should be made. Let's take, for example, Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims, the cases that gave us a constitutional mandate that every legislature be apportioned so that roughly equal numbers of people are in every district of both houses in every state legislature. In making these decisions, the court addressed what I think was a real political problem at the time, and this should not be ignored, and I think sometimes most Americans have forgotten just how unequal districts were. For example, Connecticut had districts ranging from 81,096 people to a low of 192 people. Florida had a district of 311,682 people and another of 2,868. Vermont, the districts range from 35,531 people to 24 people voting to elect a state rep. So this was a serious issue, and I don't want to get into the merits of the decision per se, but at the same time, and one can argue that judicial intervention was appropriate because these legislatures would refuse to reapportion because the people who were from the small districts didn't want to reapportion. So you could say that there was this blockage, and we could do a whole panel on all of that sort of thing. But what's important to note here is that the Supreme Court overturned the electoral system, the districts, in every single state in the union, because not a single state in the union was using equally populated districts. Okay, so we say, was this a blow in favor of democracy? We want it more equality amongst voters and so on? Arguably. But let's note that among the districts overturned was, for example, the district in Colorado. Now, the districts in Colorado were not passed by the state legislature. They were passed by the voters of the state by a majority vote. And that majority vote included not only voters in the areas that got, quote, more representation than their numbers would call for, that is the people west of the Rockies, but it included majorities in those urban areas east of the Rockies that became underrepresented, Denver, Colorado Springs, and so on. So in other words, the people voted for this, including overall the people who were getting less representation than their pure numbers might suggest. Okay, so was the Supreme Court's decision democratic or not? In the sense that it overturned the vote in Colorado. Also overturned a similar vote in California, by the way, in which under areas that became underrepresented, San Francisco and Oakland, actually voted in favor of the scheme that left them underrepresented through a plebiscite. Now, that raises the question, why would voters vote to give themselves less power? Why would we do that? Or why would we do that indirectly through our representatives from time to time? Well, I think there are a number of reasons, but I think I'll focus on this a little bit by switching to another thing that is often attacked as being undemocratic, and that is the Electoral College. Okay, in Idaho, the people of Idaho elect approximately one presidential elector for each 500,000 representatives. The people of California elect approximately one presidential elector for each 750,000 representatives, or citizens, I mean. Now, a few years ago, I was doing a program out in California, and my colleague on the panel, we were asked a question during the Q&A about the Electoral College, and my colleague, who is a very, very sharp guy, made the point, a very well-respected electoral scholar. He said that he just thought it was absurd that the citizens of Idaho had more political power than the citizens of California. And I thought to myself, although I was more diplomatic in what I actually said, but I thought to myself, are you out of your frickin' mind? Who in their right mind thinks that the citizens of Idaho, either individually or collectively, have more political power than the citizens of California because they have a 1 in 500,000 chance of getting a presidential elector versus a 1 in 750,000 chance of getting a presidential elector, if you want to enter the sweepstakes, right? Think about all the power that California has. Of course, presidential candidates are much more concerned with winning California than Idaho because it just has a lot more Electoral College votes. Moreover, part of the reason it has a lot more Electoral College votes is that it has a lot more congressmen, which gives it a lot more power in Washington. But think of the other ways that Californians have more power. Hollywood, they control so much of the culture. Silicon Valley, they control so much of the culture and social media. Because it's large and heavily populated, they have national newspapers like the LA Times, which are quoted nationally, and their pieces are reprinted by the small local papers in Idaho that can't afford their own reporters to cover these topics. So they cover them from the perspective of the LA Times. Their economy is so much more important. Plus, it's easier to get from California to the seat of government in Washington than it is to get there from Boise if you want to actually go talk to people and address people. And it's much easier to organize in densely populated cities like Sacramento and Oakland and so on than it is if you're living up in Coeur d'Alene. Okay. So, is there a reason why voters trying to think of a good system of government that will hold our country together might say, you know, I think a system that just gives a teeny little bit of extra political power on a per capita basis to the citizens of Iowa and Idaho and other states, Iowa maybe too, might be a good idea, right? Isn't this part of good government? And I note on this line, Erwin Chemerinsky, the very distinguished dean of Cal Berkeley, has written, quote, the U.S. is the only country in the world in which the candidate who loses the popular vote can be elected president, close quote. This is entirely untrue. Virtually every democracy in the world allows a person who finishes second to become the chief executive, not necessarily president, but if we include prime ministers, premiers, and so on, they can get to do this here. And I would note, for example, in the long-functioning democracies, this has happened in the United Kingdom twice since World War II, as in the United States twice since World War II. It's happened in Japan since World War II. It's happened twice in New Zealand since World War II. And I want to note, in particular, it's happened twice in Canada in 1979 and 2019, in India twice in 1991 and 1999, and in Australia no fewer than five times since World War II that a candidate has been elected prime minister with his party not getting a majority of the votes. Now, one of the things to note about those last three countries, Canada, Australia, and India, and then add the United States, each of them covers a huge geographic area and a vast multi-ethnic democracy, right? Continental democracies, these are, or subcontinent in the case of India. And I suggest to you that when we have that kind of disparity, you know, people in New York City have never seen an oil rig. If you go into Oklahoma City, there's an oil rig downtown right next to the Capitol building pumping away, okay? That these kinds of differences may merit somebody saying we need to assure that these economically important regions are in fact represented, and because they have less political power in so many ways, it's appropriate that they have a bit more in this particular way. So I would conclude by noting that as we think about these kinds of things, we should take care to recognize that much of what we call, quote, our democracy is actually part of a mixed system that intentionally includes less democratic and even anti-democratic influences, and that we talk about these undemocratic elements, or that these undemocratic elements often serve very important purposes in assuring good government and protecting our liberties overall. And we should proceed with a tremendous amount of caution when we begin to go to sort of raw political theories without thinking a whole lot about the circumstances of our country and the fact that we've been a remarkably successful democracy. I mean, we're the second oldest continuous democracy. We're the economic, military, and cultural powerhouse in the world. We are still the country to which most people say they want to immigrate if they were to immigrate, okay? And we should be very careful before we play willy-nilly with these elements on the grounds that they are in some way, quote, undemocratic. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Smith. Professor Ringham?
Thank you, and thank you very much for hosting this event. It's been very interesting, and I'm excited to be here and talk with you today. So the prompt for our panel was to talk about whether or not certain unique features of the U.S. system are more or less inconsistent with democracy, and then the prompt says, or at least majority rule. And of course, that prompt may have been written by a committee because there's a deep ambiguity, of course, built into the phrase inconsistent with democracy or at least majority rule. For those of you who were able to attend or listen to the wonderful panel last night, Professor Lowenstein elaborated at length about how democracies, certainly modern democracies, are all mixes of elements that are popular or are more or less accountable to popular electoral majorities and elements that are not, or that may be intentionally anti-majoritarian or less majoritarian in their level of responsiveness. And of course, that's correct of our system as well. We do not have and have never had a system of what, of course, James Madison called a pure democracy. And so we have a mixed system where they, like all democratic systems today, are a combination of different elements that interact in complicated ways within a system to create a system of government that as a whole meets the foundational elements of what we think representative democratic government today is, which generally speaking, of course, is a system in which a largely enfranchised adult population has the regular opportunity to elect or unelect the people, the governors, the people who represent them, and that also protects minority rights within that system from pure majoritarian control. So I found that prompt, I found it a bit hard to get traction in how to think about whether our various more and less democratic elements of our constitutional system are features or bugs. Because you really have to think about how the elements work together in a system, because there's no one right answer to how many majoritarian or non-majoritarian or anti-majoritarian elements a system should have, much less how they should play together, how the interactions between them should work. So to get some traction on this question, I found myself thinking about the chronic problem in election law. What's my baseline, right? What baseline are you going to be operating from when you're thinking about whether something has moved from being a feature to a bug? So I decided to think about this in terms of how elements of our institutional design are working or functioning today in comparison to how we might think they had been designed by the 1787 framers to work or function. How much have we deviated or are we deviating from the mix that they thought they were creating? And I found it helpful to think about that question in three distinct ways. The difference between things that are non-majoritarian or at least not simply majoritarian versus things that are anti-majoritarian, firstly. Secondly, the extent to which things that were designed to be non-majoritarian or not simply majoritarian have become more so over time. And then thirdly, the difference between the increased democratization through growing the empowered community of interest, growing the number or types of individuals who we consider to be capable of exercising the privilege of Republican self-government, versus actually growing the powers or the authority that the people so empowered have in a system. So to talk about each of those three elements of our constitutional design, starting with this difference between an element that's designed or intended to be non-majoritarian versus anti-majoritarian. So non-majoritarian is I'm not sure that that's quite the right label for this idea, but we have aspects of our system that certainly were intended to function in ways that weren't simply majoritarian, but not necessarily anti-majoritarian. And what I mean by that is elements that were built into our design to be to facilitate the growing of consensus, a consensus or a supermajority, to use a more modern term. The idea that there are some things that should not be done or some positions that should not be filled by simple majorities. That's not anti-majoritarian. That is not empowering minorities, numeric minorities, to rule themselves, to exercise political power as opposed to slowing things down. But it's an effort to grow consensus, to make sure that bare majorities don't exercise power with no support from minorities. And I think the most obvious example of that in our system was probably the Electoral College. The vision that the Electoral College design would facilitate consensus candidates that had support, particularly true in the 1787 founding era, cross-sectionally from different elements or different areas of the country. And one of the reasons that what became the Confederate States were so outraged by President Lincoln's election was because he did not enjoy that cross-sectional support, which they saw as a betrayal of the purpose of designing the presidency to ensure this consensus building so bare numeric majorities were not able to govern. And then the question would become, to the extent that we have, in the Senate. The Senate might be another example of this. The Senate was an example where there was a overrepresentation of small population states, and that may or may not have been intended to have anti-majoritarian consequences, but certainly was designed to build consensus, again, largely on sectional lines, cross-sectional lines across the country. So thinking about how those institutions work, I think with the Electoral College, the jury is out, so to speak. We have had a few presidential elections where a popular vote minority winner has won the presidency, but it is hard to know if that is a trend and if the gap is going to grow In the Senate, we're now in a position where the disproportionality of the populated versus unpopulated states is significantly higher than it had been in the past. And that would permit senators representing just 44% of the population to not just slow things down, but to affirmatively enact legislation. And that is a shift from a type of consensus building design to actually empowering numeric minority rule. So I think it's helpful to think about that spectrum and where things fall on it. Secondly, the idea that structures that even those that were designed to be anti-majoritarian themselves have become more so over time. And the Supreme Court is perhaps a example of this. Even if one starts with the premise that the Supreme Court was envisioned as an entity that would invalidate congressional legislation in marginally close calls, we have a Supreme Court that I think it is fair to say is the most powerful institution, counter-majoritarian institution in the world. Lots of apex courts across the world exercise strong U.S.-style judicial review. There are few to none who combine that with life tenure and the lack of a legislative override possibility, that there's any possibility that any sequentially enacted legislature or impaneled legislature could change that. Coupled with longer life terms, longer terms of service, and strategic retirements that functionally allow justices to bequeath their seats to their ideological allies, has changed perhaps the nature of the extent to which that entity functions in an anti-majoritarian way. And then lastly, the last way of thinking about this balance, this mix that I would flag here, is the difference between increase in democratic self-governance because we have increased the number of people who exercise political power, who are enfranchised and empowered members of the political community, versus actually increasing the power that those people have, that the electorate has. And if you think, it may be helpful to think about this. Throughout our history, including now, we think of our community. We can think of our community as consisting of three buckets of people, right? There are people who are actually empowered to exercise Republican self-government. These originally, of course, were white male property owners. We have expanded that pool to include most enfranchised or most adult citizens. But that's bucket number one, people who actually get to exercise political power themselves. They are not reliant on anyone else to be acting via proxy or virtual representation. The second bucket is people who don't get to exercise the privilege of self-government themselves, but are nonetheless considered people of relevance in the political community whose interests are supposed to be taken into account. Women, of course, were in this bucket for most of our history. Children still are. They don't exercise self-government. They are not empowered themselves. But we expect that they're of concern to the political community, and we expect their interests to be looked out for by virtual representation of others. And then the third bucket are, of course, people who we don't think are of concern in our political community at all. Enslaved individuals being the obvious example here in our early history. So if you think about those three buckets of people in their relationship to self-governance, much of our history has been fighting about who belongs in which bucket. And we've grown bucket number one. A lot more people get to exercise directly themselves self-governance. But that's not the same thing as expanding the powers that the people so enfranchised have. So just to point out that contrast, direct election of the senators that was mentioned earlier. Direct election of senators does in fact increase the power that those people have. That is a new power. I didn't realize that was going to go off loudly. That's a new power that people a new democratic power that people did not previously exercise directly. But that's actually pretty atypical. So when we think about increased democratization, we don't have a lot of public referendums, certainly at the national level, we don't have them at all. And perhaps the biggest way in which the democratic power of the enfranchised population has actually shrunk over time is the refusal to increase the size of the House of Representatives. The small size of the House of Representatives was one of the most unpopular aspects of the 1787 Constitution, and that was when there was a 30,000 person minimum. We now have House seats that are 700,000 people, and that, of course, is a diminution of the authority or democratic power of the enfranchised and empowered electorate. So that is a spectrum that I think is a useful way to think about where this balance should fall. There's not one right answer to how to balance non-majoritarian, anti-majoritarian, and democratic elements. But it is up to a people to decide where on the spectrum they want their nation to be, which I think is my handoff to Sandy.
Thank you very much for having me. Like Gloria, I want to begin with a careful look at the title. No, that is
hold on, I think you can get a little closer.
There you go. I want to begin by looking at the title, Unique Aspects of American Democracy, Structural Bugs or Features. I have increasingly become a vociferous critic of American legal education. And I assume that includes most of the law schools you go to, because I think what we do is fixate on one of the 51 constitutions of the United States, that is the United States Constitution. I happen to believe, whatever my views in the abstract are about American federalism, I happen to believe that the state constitutions are enormously interesting and remarkably different from the United States Constitution. I wrote a book in 2006 called Our Undemocratic Constitution, and I think that it is really clear beyond reasonable doubt that the United States Constitution drafted in 1787 does not meet the tests posed by any plausible 21st century theory of democracy. That's not true of the state constitutions. The state constitutions are far more democratic. Partly, one has to admit, because of the decision that Professor Smith was criticizing, that is Reynolds versus Sims, which broke the model of so-called little federalism, which I grew up in North Carolina, my home county of about 30,000 people, had the same one senator in the North Carolina legislature as Mecklenburg County, which then I think had only 200,000 people or so. That doesn't exist anymore. I don't like how North Carolina politics have gone recently, but there's no doubt that North Carolina, in many ways, is far more democratic than the United States Constitution. And I think that's true as you march through all of the states. And I think that one of the deficiencies of legal education is that we don't set you to arguing about whether the Texas Constitution or the Alabama Constitution or the California Constitution, the Constitution of wherever you might happen to live, is interestingly different from the United States Constitution, and which is better. It's also worth noting that the odds are that the state you live in has had multiple constitutions. Each of the 50 states has had just short of three constitutions over its history. Montana's constitution came along in 1972, Illinois is 1972, New Jersey is 1948. I'm a big fan of the Federalist Papers, which I'm quite convinced nobody reads any longer. And I'd be very curious, genuinely curious, how many of you in the Federalist Society, where James Madison is your avatar, have actually read the Federalist Papers, and under what conditions you read them? Were you assigned them, or do you feel it part of your general education, whether or not they are assigned? But it is an important feature of state constitutions that they live up far, far more than the national constitution does to the injunction of Alexander Hamilton in, I think, what is literally the first paragraph of Federalist One, that is, that we the people should engage in reflection and choice about how we are to be governed. My favorite state constitutions, there are 13 or 14, depending on how you count Oklahoma, which doesn't obey its own constitution in this regard. But my favorite state constitutions are the ones that require every 10 or 20 years, I think in Ohio it's every 10 years, is that right, or 12 years, that the citizenry of the state is given the opportunity to vote up or down on calling a new state constitutional convention. I really, really wish we had that at the national level, but we don't. And that turns me to looking in particular at two of the Federalist Papers that I'm quite confident are not assigned or read, because I did an informal poll. And I think the Federalist Papers for most people has been reduced to the greatest hits of number 10, 51, and 78. Anything beyond that is icing on the cake. But it does seem to me that everybody ought to read 62 and 63, both written, as it happens, by James Madison. In 62, Madison calls the Senate, that is equal allocation of voting power in the Senate, an evil. He was correct. He then said, but it's a lesser evil. What would have been the greater evil? Delaware and other small states walking out of the convention and prohibiting getting a getting constitution at all. I'm not a founder basher. This made sense in 1787 to submit to the extortionate demand of Delaware if you believed that it was necessary to have a constitution in order to prevent a very, very fragile United States from being successfully attacked by all sorts of countries and indigenous tribes who did not wish the new United States well. So Madison himself submitted to the evil, because it would have been a greater evil, say, not to have a constitution. This is the same logic as slavery, that the compromise over slavery was also thought to be an evil by people like Gouverneur Morse, but they ultimately decided it was a necessary evil. What is so remarkable about the national constitution, which I think we ridiculously overvenerate and are unwilling to be critical of, is that we don't learn the lessons of experience that Madison called on us to learn from in Federalist 14 and ask what is working well, what is not, what sort of dreadful compromises that made sense in 1787 might not make sense today, or what sort of completely sensible solutions that might have made sense in 1787 might not make so much sense today. And then I say, you look at state constitutions and you find that they're constantly updating themselves. Many of my colleagues, I think incorrectly, believe that it demonstrates what is wrong about state constitutions that they have so many amendments. There are dumb amendments and there are good amendments, but it seems to me that one of the things state constitutions reveal is the ability of legislators or the electorate in general to engage in reflection and choice and to keep updating the Constitution so it will serve the country better. We don't do that at the national level, and one of the reasons we don't do it is because I'm afraid that we train our students to think that the United States Constitution is super duper special and that it is really sacrilegious to suggest that it might have some grievous flaws. Okay, that's 62. 63 is where Madison very, very proudly says, forget we the people, in essence, we the people at the beginning of the preamble, because the greatness of the Constitution for Madison in 63 is that there's not an iota of space for actual direct governance by we the people. It's all done through representative democracy. Lori mentioned in passing the importance of initiatives and referenda. 18 states allow for initiatives and referenda, including reform of the Constitution through initiatives and referenda. That's why Nebraska very sensibly got rid of a state senate that it didn't need in 1934 through initiative and referendum. Jesse Ventura in Minnesota also came to the thoroughly rational conclusion that Minnesota, as a relatively small state, doesn't really need a separate Senate, but he didn't get it anywhere because there's no initiative and referendum in Minnesota. But it does seem to me, again, this is something to learn from American state constitutions and to ask genuinely whether we're well served by this exclusive reliance on representative democracy rather than some mix of representative democracy with the ability of people to do end runs around a sclerotic legislature, a gridlocked legislature, a legislature that is plausibly viewed wherever you are on the ideological spectrum as simply unable to rise to meet the challenges of the day. Well, many states offer ways of responding to that. We don't have the United States. So I don't know how much I've got left, but let me go very, very quickly through the other two things I wanted to say. The first thing I want to say that might surprise you, given what I suspect at least those of you from Texas know my own politics, is that I want to give at least one cheer for Governor Greg Abbott. Because in 2016, Governor Abbott submitted what he called the Texas Plan, accompanied by a 90-page brief on why we need a new constitutional convention, and he proposed 9 significant constitutional amendments. Now, not surprisingly, I don't agree with all of Governor Abbott's proposals. I probably, at the end of the day, don't agree with any of them, but some of them I certainly do agree are worth serious discussion. I'm open-minded on it. And what I applaud Governor Abbott for doing, even though he begins by saying we've got a great constitution, wonderful constitution, he then goes on to say we need a new constitutional convention to think about making the constitution really the best it can be for the 21st century. I agree with him. I strongly support a new constitutional convention, and I have a variety of my own proposals on that. One last thing for just no more than 90 seconds. One of the things I would love to see a constitutional convention do is to repeal the 1842 Congressional Act that requires single-member districts in the House of Representatives. I think that, as much if not more than gerrymandering, is what is destroying our democracy. Now, it's a congressional statute. It could be repealed. But all of us know it won't, because people are not going to vote away that which has placed them in political power. Only at the national level, constitutional convention do. If we were in California, I could stand at a street corner and ask you to sign petitions to repeal the 1842 Act and require Texas, say, to be divided into 6 congressional districts with 6 or 7 representatives in each district elected by proportional representation, which would mean that Republicans could elect fair and square a representative from Travis County, and Democrats could elect fair and square representatives from West Texas. You can do the same sort of thing about Manhattan, about Los Angeles, about other areas that right now are locked up for one party and do not help our polity at all. So that is my view on why one ought not focus entirely on the United States Constitution as the instantiation of American democracy.
Thank you, Professor Levinson.
Professor Barclay?
Is my mic on? Okay. There's no light, so thank you. It's a treat to get to speak with these distinguished panelists, and thank you to the Federalist Society, University of Texas, and Judge Bumate. And I will also thank the youngest member of the Federalist Society today, which is my daughter, who's here with me. She's celebrating her birthday this weekend, and I didn't want to not be with her on her birthday. And when she told me she wanted to come, I thought, even better, we're having a democracy-themed birthday party. you're all invited. And that's how you train them up young.
Yes.
So.
Brilliant.
I'm really grateful for the chance to speak about this topic. It's a particularly timely one to me to think about unique aspects, both features and bugs, of our democracy compared to other democracies. This year, I'm living in the United Kingdom. I'm a professor at Notre Dame Law School, and I'm teaching out of our London campus. You may not have known we have a London campus, but we do. And doing some research in Oxford about the role of constitutional adjudication in a democracy. And it's been interesting for me to think more about our democracy from the vantage point of different democracies. I was walking down the street in London last fall, and there was a big crowd of people on the street, and I was like, is this a group of tourists? Is a parade coming? And so I said, what are you guys waiting for? And they were like, oh, the prime minister is going to be sacked any minute, and we want to watch. They were all just camped out waiting for that. And we were there during that time that Liz Truss now holds the record for the shortest prime minister ever for 49 days. Some of our English neighbors were teasing my 9-year-old son that they like to change their prime ministers more frequently than he changes his underwear, which sometimes might be true. It's a good reminder, too, that while we have difficulties and challenges in our democracy, that's universal, I think, of governance anywhere. And just as Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried. I have to admit I'm a little partial, and I feel like our democracy is the worst democracy, except for all the other ones. Like, there's a lot going on out there, and there's a lot to be really grateful for in our country. Today I'm going to talk about three different features that I think are particularly attractive about our democracy and that are unique compared to other democratic countries, and then a few bugs that I think are worth thinking about a little bit harder. I mean, I appreciate Sandy's point that it's worth thinking critically about our own system of government. The definition of democracy I find really persuasive is one offered by Philip Pettit in his book On the People's Terms, and he argues that the most legitimate form of democracy, or the way to measure legitimacy, is based on control by the people. He talks about control that is effective, direct, accessed equally by all citizens. This is an ideal that can never perfectly be realized across the board, but it can certainly be realized in some instances, and it is a practical sort of ideal that does have real-world implications. This is different than pure majoritarianism, and as I'll discuss a little bit later, direct democracy. It has a lot of room for government acting as agents of the people. One of the features that I think is unique and special about our democracy is one we may not talk about all the time, but the fact that our Constitution was ratified through constitutional conventions. And under Article 5, it is state conventions, including some of the ones that Sandy was talking about, and 2/3 of the Congress that can propose new amendments. When constitutional conventions were used in our country to ratify democracy, Gordon Wood talks about how up until this point in England, conventions were viewed as inferior to legal authority by Parliament. But in the United States, when we were going about our ratification process, they came to be viewed as a way that the people were acting directly as sovereigns. It went with the idea that people do control government and speak differently than just the normal legislative process. Kurt Lash explained that this became understood as the acceptable way through which people were most directly exercising their authority. If you compare this to, say, Australia, or a lot of other countries, for example, they basically amend their constitution or ratify their constitution by a normal act of legislation. It's just their Congress that then passes or amends or does whatever they want to their constitution. Why does that matter for our constitution? Is because it gives much more legitimacy to this idea that there is a supreme law that has been passed by a super majoritarian power and therefore demands greater adherence and can also be used as a measuring stick for the other laws that we have in our country. Another implication which is related and another feature of our democracy that I think we do quite well is relates to the principle of subsidiarity, this idea that those who govern and are going to be most affected by a policy should have access and the ability to govern. The Supreme Court has talked about how in our country we split the atom of sovereignty. This was again a novel idea, but the idea of people being sovereigns and so retaining power and then giving some to the federal government, but some to the state governments. And it's not as though the people gave all of their power away. One interesting indication of that is, of course, the Ninth Amendment for the federal government, that the people retain some of their powers. But something that we don't talk about as often is the fact that many of the state constitutions, in fact, 12 of them at the time of early antebellum legislative era, also had amendments that basically replicated the Ninth Amendment. This idea that all government is acting as agents of the people and they retain power over certain areas that government just can't intrude on. When it comes to federalism, I think that the fact that we're able to have one of the largest countries in the world and a country that is not united by common history, language, religion, there's so much less that unifies us, and yet that we're still able to operate and govern well and have the largest GDP, I think is in large part one of the, I mean, there's many features that lead to this, but I think subsidiarity is really helpful because people can choose, depending on the part of the country, like the great state of Texas, what sort of policies that they want to have. We really saw this on display, I think, during COVID. I mean, it was a very different world to live in New York during COVID, and they had reasons for that based on their population density. Then if you went to Idaho, my husband and I visited Idaho during COVID, you would have no idea that there was a worldwide pandemic going on. None. But the flexibility of people to decide for themselves what suits their framework, I think, is a really important feature and a valuable feature of our democracy. I want to talk a little bit now about the Republican form of government, which Sandy talked about in the Federalist Papers, and Lori mentioned as well. Sometimes we often talk about the idea that direct democracy is more democratic and that representative democracy is sort of a second best if we're thinking about what is most democratic. One argument that is made in the book Democratic Devices and Desires by Brennan and Hamlin is that, in fact, if we're thinking about control by the people as our criteria, representative democracy often gives more control to the people. It allows for a more deliberative process that will be more responsive to their interests. In part, this is based on rational actor sort of theory, where often people don't have a lot of incentive in advance to learn everything that they need to know about policies and to govern well. But they have a lot of incentive post hoc if there is a politician or government official who acts in an entrepreneurial way and says, here's a new policy you may not have thought of before, but you like it, I promise, just like people do with new toothpaste or whatever, in the normal market. And then the people, like consumers of policies, get to decide, was that helpful, was that not? And that sort of process often ends up being more responsive to the interests of the people than direct democracy would. That's not to say that there's no place for referenda. I certainly agree with Sandy that that's true, that they can be a valuable piece of democracy. But it's also interesting to see, like in the UK, for example, ask them how they feel about the referenda process that led to Brexit. There's a lot of buyer's remorse. That was not a real deliberative process. It's, an interesting question. Was that really representing the interests of all of the people better than elected representatives who were trying to be responsive of the whole common good of the community would be? So talking just briefly, I'll turn to some of the bugs of our democracy. I happen to think that the rise of the filibuster in the Senate has been a bug of our democracy. And I'm not that sad that we have seen the filibuster decrease when it comes to some presidential appointments. The filibuster really didn't start until 1806. It has a bit of a complicated history, but it was on the greatest rise around the 1970s. It basically means that two-fifths of the senators can impose a requirement that a bill gain the support of three-fifths of the Senate to pass through the institution. When you combine the filibuster with the rise of political parties, both things that I think our framers did not anticipate, that's a lot of veto players in our Congress, and I think it's a reason why Congress has a hard time passing legislation. I think it's more difficult than it should be. Why is that a problem for our democracy? Because there will still be enormous pressure to pass some policies, and for sure, passing policies were meant to be difficult. But I think we sort of have seen these safety valves like spring a leak in terms of administrative action, which I think is not good when we see the executive taking on so much more of the lawmaking function. And then as sort of a check and balance to that, you have seen the rise of universal injunctions by the judiciary. And so you might have a sub-agency governing by effectively blog post. I mean, sometimes agencies are posting a new policy that affects the whole country on their website with no notice and comment, no deliberation, not a lot of control by the people. And then you have one lone district court that plaintiffs have forum shopped in one state who issues an injunction that shuts down the policy for the entire country. And this is like the ping pong game that we're playing that doesn't look particularly democratic to me, doesn't seem to be anticipated in the frame of our original constitution, and I think often doesn't leave a lot of control for the people. I will go ahead and pause there and turn the time over to my other panelists.
Perfect, thank you so much. So we have about 45 minutes for Q&A. Before we begin that, I wanted to see if any of the panelists wanted to respond to anything they've heard by other panelists. Professor Smith, do you?
No, I'd like to hear a question.
Okay, great. Professor Winkle? Ringham, sorry.
I just want to emphasize something Stephanie just talked about, the constitutional ratifying conventions in the states, because I think it's fascinating. I wish I had put it in my talk. That there's such a good example of this mixture of democratic and supermajoritarian requirements, because of course the 1787 framers required a supermajority of state conventions to ratify the new constitution. It required 9 out of 13, not 7 out of 13. But the conventions themselves, of course, were intentionally outside of the state legislatures. They involved an expanded franchise. Virtually every state allowed more people to vote for delegates to go to the convention than were empowered to vote for members of the state legislature. And the conventions, the state conventions themselves often ratified, or in Rhode Island's case, failed to ratify by bare majorities. So it really is this nice mix of the different aspects of how we divvy up political power.
Thank you. Professor Levinson?
Yeah, I want to pick up on Stephanie's citation of the Churchill quote. The problem with the quote, I think, and I presume this is what was discussed last night, is that democracy is an essentially contested concept. We can all agree that democracy is better than North Korea or China or Cuba. That's not really an interesting debate, in fact. What we have to decide is which among the, let us say, 20 different versions of democracy that are on the table, if you look only within the United States, this is why I think it's so important to look at state constitutions, let alone if you look at other countries around the world that are widely thought to be democratic, whether it's the UK, the Scandinavian countries, Spain, or whatever. I am happy to stay within the United States and to suggest that you be encouraged to argue among yourself whether Texas, which violates almost every conceivable tenet of the unitary executive, which is fine with me, or New Jersey, which comes very, very close to the national notion of the so-called unitary executive, both of those can be defended in terms of plausible theories of democracy, but which is better in the 21st century and why? What about initiatives and referenda? What about getting rid of little federalism? What about, for that matter, preemption by state governments of local government? Texas has 28 million people right now. That's 6.5 times the entire population of the United States in 1790. Stephanie talks about subsidiarity. I assure you that we who live in Austin would love it if the Texas legislature, about 300 yards from here, believed in subsidiarity. They don't. And this is a serious issue in state governments across the country, where state legislatures are hostile to localities that they view as doing unwise things. This is a real issue of democracy. So, you know, I think it's time to retire the Churchill quote, unless somebody really says, you know, I think the Democratic Republic of North Korea really presents a fine model of democracy. And at that point, you know, go at them.
Professor Barclay?
I agree. I totally agree with Sandy, that we should be paying more attention to state constitutions. And Judge Sutton has a terrific book about that that I would recommend to you all. But remember, Sandy, I wasn't just giving Churchill's quote. I was saying, I'm going to add to that and say, I think our version of democracy in the United States is better than the other versions, and here's why. Because I do think that there are features that other democracies have that are attractive. I think we're doing really well, but then if we're going to ask within the United States which democracies are better, I think that's an interesting and important question, and you're absolutely right. I think we shouldn't treat it as though the Constitution we have right now is perfect. It's not. It's a work in progress. Article 5 anticipates that it should be changed, and I think, or it is open to change, and I think channeling more of the energies of democratic change and updating into that process, as opposed to things like administrative action or an activist judiciary, which, you know, gave rise in the 1970s around the time legislation became particularly difficult to pass. I think those are things that we should continue to think about.
Great. Thank you. So, Professor Smith, the one question I had is, it seems to say that, you seem to say that you don't think that what's democratic is not the rubric by which we should be judging judicial decisions and other government action. What rubric or standard would you use in evaluating government actions?
Well, I generally would say that I think the Supreme Court should be very hesitant to adopt political theories and impose them as one size fits all. For example, to play off Sandy's very last comment, you know, subsidiarity may be not appreciated here by the Texas legislature. I don't really know Texas politics, but one would say that Texas is a place where it matters more than in, say, Rhode Island, simply because of the vast geographic expanse and the differences in the state. And you can see changes like that. For example, I mentioned the problem the court was addressing in the one-person, one-vote cases, as they, I think, somewhat erroneously are called, Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims and so on. And I think you can make a strong argument that the court really made a mistake in imposing one-size-fits-all on states. There may be reasons why a unique state like Hawaii would say, look, we're going to give a representative to each island, or where Michigan wants to give a representative to the Upper Peninsula, or where Colorado, with a clear dividing line between the Front Range and then the western part of the state, you know, that those states would have reasons for doing it. And at the time, in that case, it was argued very much. In fact, the plaintiffs argued amongst themselves whether they should go for a one-person, one-vote requirement, or just say, you have to have a rational basis for your plan. The reason you have your plan can't just be, well, we haven't redistricted since 1870 and we like it that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that I'm not quite sure this answers your question, but my basic approach would be to say that the court should be very cautious about adopting these kinds of theories of democracy and saying, here's what it means. And I would suggest that may be true as well in like Moore v. Harper and other types of cases.
Thank you. Professor Ringen, I like your dichotomy of the non-majoritarian versus anti-majoritarian. I believe you put the courts in the anti-majoritarian column, but you also seem to be criticizing how it's become overly anti-majoritarian. So what would be the benefit of making courts less anti-majoritarian?
I think I would go back to the political checks on the court that are embedded in the Constitution itself, right? I think we think of the court as, I think lawyers and law students and law faculty perhaps in particular, like to idealize the court. We think of the court as outside the political system, but that's not what our constitutional design is. Our constitutional design embeds the Supreme Court within a system that is not just a checker, but is also checked. It is checked through regular appointments that occur through a political process by elected officials, and it is potentially checked by the exceptions clause and court's ability to, or Congress's ability to structure the composition of the court. And we have, for I think a variety of reasons, some good, some bad, become timid about using those checks. And when that is combined with extended terms and life tenure, and really, and I think Stephanie's point is very well taken about the growth of judicial power because of the kneecapping of Congress, that there are decisions that need to be made and someone's going to fill the gap. So that juxtaposition of things, it's not, I'm less concerned about how a court decides a case than I am about a court that escapes the type of indirect but still accountability to the political aspects of our Constitution.
Professor Barclay, did you want to respond?
Yeah, I think this is also a really interesting question, and Professor Ringhan raises a lot of points just about thinking about the role of the judiciary and its expansive power over time. It's, I think, worthwhile considering how some other democracies handle their also counter-majoritarian institution of the court. So in Canada, for example, they use this rarely, but it has been used by some of the provinces. If there's legislation that the parliament doesn't want to be subject to judicial review or wants to override a decision by the court, they have Section 33, the notwithstanding clause. So they can sometimes legislatively say, we have a different view of the Constitution than you, the court, do. And it's an interesting thing to think about, because while I think we really value in our country that our Constitution should be very difficult to amend for rule of law reasons, it, you know, it's an open question. Should a decision by five justices that is wildly unpopular be that difficult to overturn only by constitutional amendment if it really runs counter to either the original meaning of the Constitution and, you know, what the people want? There's also, in Ireland and the UK have similar procedures, they're not exactly the same, but that can be done legislatively with their highest courts. I think it's interesting that in the UK, because of their term limits, nobody knows who the justices are, really, for the most part, whereas, after last term, I think nobody in America doesn't know who our justices are, right? And so, but interesting to think about that when you think of how the framers did envision the Supreme Court being the least dangerous branch of government. One other thing that I do think is interesting in some other democracies, including the UK, is that they have a more robust sort of political questions doctrine, meaning that we shouldn't just ask what's the right legal question here, which as originalists we'd say, well, what's the original meaning, but maybe spend more time on the antecedent question, even if we agree with judicial review generally, is this the type of question that the judiciary should be answering, which in and of itself is an originalist question. Is there enough original support for the idea that the court should be mediating this dispute between other political branches that might have plenty of incentives and tools at their disposal to have their own thoughts and to defend their own turf constitutionally?
Thank you. And so I'll have one last question, and then I'll open up to the floor if people want to start lining up for questions. But along the lines, Professor Levinson, it's, you know, it seems like one of the themes going on is that the Constitution is just too hard to amend. Do you agree with that? You know, state constitution amendments are obviously easier. What should the process? What would the amendment process look like in your ideal world?
I'm less inclined to think in terms of an ideal world than thinking of concrete realities, as for that matter, people in 1787 mm-hmm. were doing. It seems to me beyond doubt that the United States Constitution is too hard to amend. If you simply look at comparative constitutions, both abroad and again, coming back to my hobby horse, the American states, we have the hardest to amend constitution in the world. And in 1787, ironically enough, they thought they were easing the process, which was true in 1787. Because one of the remarkable things about 1787 is that they simply chose to ignore and disobey Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation, which very clearly, if you are a textualist, it is hard to get around the fact that Article 13 required unanimous consent of the legislatures in all of the states. This is why Rhode Island very stupidly decided not to send anybody to Philadelphia at all, because they relied on Article 13 to give them a veto. Article 7 of the Constitution simply erased Article 13 and said that the new Constitution comes into being when you get nine conventions, not legislatures, in nine states. My home state, North Carolina and Rhode Island, were not in the Union when George Washington was inaugurated, and it didn't matter. That's very important. Today, I would like a system that, let us say, required majority approval of a majority of the states with a majority of the population, rather than the ridiculous three-quarters of the states that, in theory, could be one-third, one-quarter plus one of the states, I think, in theory, could be something like 6%. Of the national population. Now, that's not going to happen, but it's still the case that the three-quarters rule gives inordinate power to those who want to preserve the status quo, whatever, whether it's a liberal or conservative status quo, doesn't matter. I would allow states to propose constitutional amendments. I wish we had a regular process of conventions, as a lot of states do, so that it wouldn't be viewed as the end of the world. I suspect that my California friends over there, most Californians I know don't like direct democracy, but I actually think overall that it is a feature rather than a bug, that going back to the progressive era, the people of many states can in fact propose amendments and then see if they're ratified by a majority of the people. Most importantly, I would love to have a genuine national discussion where members of the Federal Society would meet with members of the American Constitution Society and really hash out what are tough issues as to what would be best for the country today. I don't have my ideal system. What I am convinced of is that Article 5 is remarkably non-ideal and needs amendment.
Great, and so we'll open it up to the floor. So before you ask your question, please state your name and your school, and please make sure your question is actually a question, too. So go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Stephen Taft here from Richmond Law. So I want to ask about Article 5, actually. So just to preface, when you think about it, of course, the amendment power is kind of terrifying, and a lot of thinkers from Calhoun to much less, you know, controversial thinkers have pointed this out, of course, and I mean, the amendment process is God on earth. The Supreme Court can't do anything, and if you amend something, you can imagine 4 + 4 = 5, and the amendment says that, and the Supreme Court trying to kind of do this on their fingers, and they're stuck with it. So I want to ask directly about the convention system under Article 5, because if I'm not mistaken, we've never actually used that method since the original 10 amendments of the Bill of Rights. Now, how do you all think that system, if we ever resorted back to it for passing any kind of amendment, how should that look mechanically in each state? Because a convention can be anything from everyone in this room declaring themselves the Texas Convention to a referendum or what have you. We've never really done it for 200 years, so how do you all think that should look?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, there have been about 235 state conventions, and again, this is just the kind of deliberate ignorance of most law professors, so that we say, you're absolutely correct, that there's not been a convention since 1787. What that means is that there's not been a national convention since 1787. There have been the 235 state conventions, and they've not turned into horror shows, because in fact, even if you have some crazies at a convention, which you will, they're going to be outbalanced by sane people within the community, the political process. Those people who fear the prospect of amendment is terrifying because of a wrong convention, I always point out that Congress could tomorrow declare war against Mexico and Canada. That is clearly constitutional. That is clearly a power of Congress. And if you say, well, the president would veto that, doesn't matter. 2/3 could override it. We would be at war with Mexico and Canada. But I suspect that none of us, whatever our ideological leanings, goes to bed fearful that Congress tomorrow is going to engage in lunatic policy. And it seems to me the same thing is true about a convention, unless, as I fear is true of people across the ideological spectrum, certainly including my friends on the left, there is so little faith any longer in genuinely popular government or in we the people that you project a notion of truly popular government as a group of crazed individuals who would do the equivalent of declaring war on Canada, if only they could.
Professor Barclay, you wanted to respond?
I totally agree with what Professor Levinson is saying. And one interesting sort of case study of, I think, a country that let this fear of the idea of the amendment process lead to a much less desirable result is India. So India's amendment provision in their constitution said that the judiciary was not able to do anything to interfere with the people's ability to amend the constitution. And the Indian Supreme Court said in a series of decisions, yes, we can, and that constitutional provision is unconstitutional. And there are provisions of the Constitution that are unamendable, including judicial review. And also, we're in charge of who appoints the judges. and all in the name of democracy, right? Like, because, well, those crazy wild-eyed people through the amendment process could undermine democracy, so we better not let that happen. So we're going to make our Constitution unamendable and protected by the judiciary, and they will be the guardians of democracy. I mean, I think it's a wildly undemocratic thing. I would also say to Sandy, I think some countries like India and Africa and even some provisions of Germany that have now made their constitution unamendable are by definition even more difficult to amend than ours. So we're not the worst when it comes to that. But I think that Sandy's right that yes, there are risks inherent in any system of governments, but I'd rather take my bets with the people and their ability to decide whether we're going to war with Canada or not than leave that all up to non-responsive government bodies.
Go ahead, Professor Smith.
I just want to say I generally agree with Sandy's take on conventions. They don't really frighten me. But I just wanted to add that I think the argument can certainly be made that our Constitution is too hard to amend and it should be easier to amend. On the other hand, I don't think I would go as far as Sandy. I think sometimes it's just that we've quit trying to amend the Constitution. We quit trying in the 20th century when we decided we'd just have the Supreme Court do it. And I think that's been a problem, and it's taken constitutional debate out of our public sphere. We can amend the Constitution. You know, in 1800, we had a real problem with the Electoral College, and bam, we had a constitutional amendment. I mean, people saw it was a problem. It was gone. Meanwhile, another example would be Prohibition. I mean, people just decided we should put this in the Constitution, and they worked for it, and it took a while, but it was done. And the Constitution should be hard to amend. And, you know, by the way, Prohibition didn't work very well, and when we saw it didn't work, it was gone. It didn't take barely a decade. So I think we just need to think more sometimes about actually trying to amend the Constitution. And if we can't do it, maybe it's not such a great idea that we want to write it into our Constitution. So I'm not averse to making it easier, per se. I don't know quite how we would do that. But I don't fear the state constitutional conventions. But I think sometimes we just need to go back to the idea that you need a constitutional amendment to do that. Get to it.
Great. Let's go to this side.
Andy Yuan with the University of Texas. My question, so Max Weber defines government as the legitimate monopoly of violence. So, you know, we spend a lot of time waxing poetic on, how do we democratically govern? But we're really talking about how do we collectively exert violence on our neighbors without really thinking about, there's a there's democratizing force in non-government, allowing people to individually make decisions. Is the existence of government and the continued growth of government a bug or a feature? And could you talk a little bit more about that?
I'll make a real quick comment.
Go for it.
Which is just to say that I find it interesting that no one here has brought up just the growth of the administrative state as something that is anti-democratic. And I'm just glad to hear that the libertarians are finally getting up and talking.
go ahead.
I don't have much to add. I would just note people who actually live without government in systems governed or in systems of anarchy don't tend to feel very free.
One other very small comment is that the idea that government is monopolizing coercive power doesn't mean that that coercion has to be used, right? So part of the reason good governance often might be monopolizing that power is to say, nobody's using that. Neighbors aren't using it against each other. We're not using that against each other. And I think that's an important tool in the toolkit as well.
Let's go to this side.
Jameson Payne, Heritage Foundation. Professor Levinson, you cite Federalist 62 for the proposition that Madison kind of had a cynical view of the Senate as just being kind of a means of appeasing the small states. But immediately after his saying that in 62, he actually goes on further to say that it is also an instrument and guarantor of the sovereignty of states, which they did not fully cede in forming the Union, and that it ensures that they can still make their own decisions. He also immediately after that says that it is a instrument of preventing ill-considered but majority-approved legislation, which he says government is liable to do from time to time, and that it may find itself more convenient in practice than just in contemplation. So I'm curious if you also think that those arguments are cynical based on kind of appeasement of small states, and if not, what role should those arguments play in how we structure our amendment process, our wider legislation process, our system of government? Thank you.
I don't think he was being cynical in 62. I think he was being quite candid that the explanation for equal allocation of voting power was the political situation, the need for compromise. All politics requires compromise, sometimes really quite dreadful compromise. That's what he thought it was, a dreadful compromise. I agree with you that he does not attack bicameralism. I don't attack bicameralism. I think that states as small as New Zealand internationally, which would include Nebraska or Minnesota or quite a few American states, have no need for a second house, especially if there's a governor with a veto. That would provide enough separation of powers. But it does seem to me, Texas with 28 million people, which is wildly diverse in population and in cultures within the 28 million people, I think it's a good idea to have two houses. So I don't object to that aspect of 62. I don't think that Madison was being at all cynical. I think that one of the really important questions to be hashed out in a constitutional convention would be what a second house should look like, that it shouldn't simply mirror the first house except having longer terms. We could be more imaginative in creating second houses that were really interestingly different in important ways. Larry Sabato, for example, at the University of Virginia, a number of years ago suggested that all former presidents or vice presidents or former justices of the Supreme Court, or maybe only chief justices of the Supreme Court, or head of the Joint Chiefs, or head of the Fed, or the like, should be ex officio members. Former secretaries of state should be ex officio members, because one of the really dreadful things about Congress is that every member of Congress in the House or the Senate, unless he or she looks in the mirror and sees a president, has no incentive to think nationally. The incentive is always to think in terms of, quite frankly, pandering to the local constituency. And what Sabato was suggesting is that it would be a good idea to have in the Senate some people who think nationally or internationally and bring their experience to bear. So, I don't denounce bicameralism, certainly not in a country as large as we are. It would be a crazy idea to say that New Zealand is the model for the United States. But I do think that there is room to argue about Madison's specific belief that the Senate would provide the kind of cures to faction that he was positing.
Anyone else? Okay, let's go to this side.
I'm Eli Burstein from Michigan. One of the unique aspects of our Constitution is that our national capital doesn't have representation on par with states. Do you find that to be a bug or a feature?
Feature.
It's certainly a unique feature of the United States Constitution. Australia gives, carves out area of Canberra as a separate state or a separate unit with some representation. Brasilia, I think, is separated from the rest of Brazil, but has representation. My family, or part of my family, lives in Washington. As I presume most of you know, the license plates in Washington say, no taxation without representation, and that's not a bad slogan.
Can Okay, let's go to this side.
I don't think think there is any other region or population in this country that we would so lightly tolerate being deprived of representation in our federal government.
Ilya Selman, George Mason University. Federalist 62 has already come up several times, and it's one of my favorites also, so I wonder if I could raise yet another quote from Federalist 62 that perhaps the panelists can comment on, that in there, Madison says, "It will be of little avail to the people that the laws are made by men of their own choice if the laws be so voluminous that they cannot be read, or so incoherent that they cannot be understood." And it seems to me that we're long past the point where Madison's fear about that has been realized, that the federal government, even aside from the states, regulates almost every aspect of human activity. Most of the people have very little idea of most of the policies that the federal government enacts on most issues. That's to a large extent true at the state level as well. Indeed, it's even gotten to the point where most of the members of Congress don't know very much about most of the policies that they vote on, because again, they're busy people, they have lots of other things to pay attention to, and for the voters, it's actually rational for them to pay very little attention to politics, precisely because, as Bradley Smith noted, you usually have only a one in many millions chance that your vote will actually make a difference. So it seems like there is a trade-off between having democratic accountability in the sense of an electorate that actually understands what's going on and can appropriately assess whether the representatives are doing a good job or not, and having a government that controls as many aspects of our lives as it currently does. There are ways that you can try to wave this away and say, well, voters have wonderful information shortcuts that they can use without knowing much about policy. I've written an entire chapter of a book explaining why that's probably wrong, at least for government of our size. Or you can say, well, it's fine to be sort of undemocratic or have weak accountability in this way. And there are other answers that can be given as well. I won't go through all the possible answers, but I do think this is an issue that needs to be confronted if we're talking about, how democratic the Constitution should be, whether elements of it are undemocratic and so forth, that when we've gotten to a point where most of what government does is things that most voters don't know about and don't understand the effects of and so on, that's at least a potential problem, even if, maybe there's some brilliant answer to it, or maybe James Madison said, maybe it's an evil we have to accept.
Thank you.
So that's the question. Thank you.
Professor Berkeley, you want to start? Go ahead.
I totally agree that this is a serious problem that we're facing in our democracy. Under the previous administration, OIRA passed a requirement, basically that all agencies needed to put all of their existing rules and regulations on a website, like compile them. And it was interesting, Paul Ray has spoken about this, he was the head of OIRA at the time, and he said he had a number of different agencies call, and they were like, yeah, so we don't know where all our regulations are. We don't know how to compile them. Sort of like, well, if you don't, how on earth are the American people supposed to know the laws that they're subject to, some of them with criminal penalties? And Justice Gorsuch has written about cases he adjudicated at the Tenth Circuit where the government was applying the wrong version of its own laws because they have become so voluminous. So I agree it's a problem and something we need to think about more.
I would push back a bit on your premise that this is new. Think about what life looked like in 1787, right? The voters who chose delegates to go to their state conventions had not even seen a copy of the Constitution. They were casting votes at a very general level for delegates who either supported a stronger federal government or did not. And there were individual issues that piqued public attention, and they varied a bit across the country. But our legislation has grown more complex. Obviously, that is true. Our communication and our access to information has grown much stronger, and things are much more accessible in that way. And I think, one of the things I say to my students a lot in class is, you don't get to start. It is too cheapish of a shortcut to argue that if you lose a political fight, it's because your opponents are uninformed or evil. And voters have often used shortcuts and proxies and indicators of where they see their interest line. I don't think knowing what's in paragraph 152 of the Affordable Care Act is a requirement to be a good democratic citizen. And if it is, then we've never had that.
I think Gloria is absolutely right. I think that Ilya is really touching on two issues. One is the ever greater complexity of modern life in all respects, and the fact that none of us really has any firm idea about more than a very small portion of the world and how it operates. And then that brings up the second crucial issue, which is trust. And so when people talk about fragmentation, polarization, the country at the brink of civil war, which I think is true, I think that is a proxy for mistrust, that you demonize your opponents, you don't think they're in good faith, you don't think they're guided by data, you think they're simply imposing an alien ideology on you. And I don't think any government can survive if there's not some measure of trust in public officials and their good faith, even if you disagree with them. Having given one cheer for Greg Abbott, let me give at least 1.5 cheers for Adrian Vermeule's book, which I suspect some of you have read. One of the things that's truly interesting or bizarre about Adrian's book, depending on your perspective, is that it is the warmest embrace of the administrative state that I have read in a long, long time, even as he denounces in the most vociferous language political liberalism and makes the argument that we need to return to the verities of ancient times. But it does seem to me that he's onto something in suggesting that no modern country can do without administrative state. And the fact that administrators are going to make decisions we can't understand. In 1787, I presume ordinary people could understand such regulations as there were about where you could take your cart and horse. I want a federal agency to tell Boeing which planes are safe to fly or not, or to tell railroads under what circumstances it is safe to ship vinyl chloride and under what circumstances that's a mistake. I don't think they worried about such issues in 1787. We do.
We'll go to this side. I think we have time for two more questions. Go for it.
My name is Kevin Hills. I'm from the University of Pittsburgh Law. My question is for Professor Barclay, but it's open for the other panelists. So looking at Europe, we see the countries but seem to overlook the EU. Which seems to incorporate some elements of American constitutional structure, such as the Council of the EU mirroring the original formation of the US Senate. Does the EU offer a better metric compared to the US as a comparison, and does it offer lessons and warnings on looking at this issue?
I mean, one interesting thing with the EU is that a lot of the requirements have to also be adopted with implementing legislation at the national level. And so there's sort of like a different interaction going on between the countries and the EU, and there's interesting debate about who's the primary sovereign in that context. I haven't thought a lot about lessons that it teaches us for our democracy, other than I do think that there have been a lot of concerns raised in Europe when you have requirements that are being imposed on different countries with different cultures with different legal scenarios, and sometimes that aren't a good fit. And I think it's an example of how subsidiarity isn't always applied as effectively in that context. And sometimes we do it well in the United States, and sometimes we don't.
Yeah, they use, this is more in the European Convention of Human Rights than in the EU proper, but there's two notions that I think are of interest in how that's been implemented across nations in Europe. One is the margin of appreciation, right? The notion that differences within different nations can
manifest differently when rights from the European Convention of Human Rights are being enforced. That is not unproblematic, particularly in how it is sometimes used, but it provides kind of a body of jurisprudence to think about how to implement federalism in the rights sphere, which is something we don't often talk about. We assume once something is deemed to be a federally protected right, then that conversation is over. The other thing that's interesting, and I think has some neat lessons, is the way that the UK in particular has domesticated the implementation of the European Convention of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights is an apex court. It has assumed it's quite a powerful court. And what the UK did when it implemented domestic legislation, when it enacted domestic legislation in order to make that jive with the idea of parliamentary sovereignty, was it created a mechanism where if the government in power wants to not comply with something that the European Court of Human Rights has said it's obligated to do, there's a process by which they have to actually say that publicly, that they have to give reasons, and that they have to kind of take accountability for the decision to implement or choose to not implement. So it makes sure, I think one of the issues in many of the things we've been talking about, some of our processes have lost political accountability, and the filibuster might be a great example of this. It used to be very visible, that imposed a cost. Now it's invisible, it's a paper thing, so it doesn't impose a cost and becomes routine. So those types of transparency mechanisms.
I think it would be a good final exam question whether the EU is more like the system under the Articles of Confederation, where unanimity really was professed to be important, or whether it is more like the consolidated government of the Constitution, where unanimity was discarded in favor of, you know, of Article 5, which they thought is opening it up. So, you know, I think it was insane to give Slovakia, a veto over the power of the central bank, I think back in 2010 or whenever it was really crucial that the central bank would impose certain monetary policies. Slovakia ended up agreeing, but it was, I think, kind of insane to believe that Slovakia alone could block that. And, you know, I think I would answer my own question saying that Europe today is still more in the Articles of Confederation stage than the consolidated constitution stage.
Okay, we got time for one more question.
Hi, I'm Trey Donathan from American University Washington College of Law, and I want to ask about two potential issues of the American democratic system with a focus on the majoritarian versus anti-majoritarian perspectives. The first is with the House of Representatives. It's based primarily off of population rather than geography. So wouldn't that favor urban governance rather than over rural governance? And the second part is under the assumptions that elections are kind of won and lost based off like how much funding a candidate has, how do like super PACs, interest groups, and like other like lobbyist groups like not favor wealthy voters over non-wealthy voters?
So on the House of Representatives, I mean, obviously what population-based apportionment favors is population. And if that means that there, if urban areas have more representation, it is because they have more people. So that is the population-based element of our Constitution. That's where that lives. And wealth-based disparities, I think Brian will probably speak to.
Well, the campaign finance issue is obviously a very complex issue. Commissioner Goodman spoke about it a little bit on the last panel. Suffice it to say that the key elements in political races are generally whether or not a candidate is well-funded, not who spends more. And we generally find that, you know, both the major parties in the United States are able to be well-funded. Obviously, people who have more money have more ability to participate in that game, But it's hard, if you really think about it, to think of what voices in the United States are not actually heard. There's a wide representation. And in my view, efforts to limit campaign donations and to limit campaign spending actually tend to empower the elites, because you're reducing the number of people who can play the game. And the more people who can play the game, and remember there's various other forms of political power besides money, the more people who can play the game, the more likely you are to have every view getting heard. There are lots of eccentric millionaires out there who fund, you know, causes that in the stereotype of Thurston Howell III, they would never fund. And there are, you know, all kinds of, it's just a very complex issue. So I guess I would say that at a certain level, you're right. Yeah, if you have more money, you get to participate more. But I think the empirics, and I think both deeper theory, suggests that that's really an incomplete way of looking at the system. And again, that our efforts to regulate that have tended to make it worse rather than better. And this, like so many things in democracy, is where we need to take a second best solution. And to me, that's open participation.
We have 1 minute left if you want to have the last word. Go ahead, Professor.
One of the issues that I hope would be discussed at a constitutional convention would obviously be the electoral process in all of its ways, including whether you'd want to move toward a more parliamentary system or presidential system. Well, let's assume a presidential system. One of the ways that the national government differs from, I think it's 46 or 47 of the American state governments, is that presidential elections are winner take all. So that one of the reasons so much money and effort is put into presidential elections is that you get control of the administrative state. For better or for worse, that's what presidential elections are really about. Whereas, you know, take Texas, where the governor, whatever one thinks of the governor, is not all that powerful, because the heads of the agencies are elected. There's a split between the president, the governor, and the AG in almost all of the states. And I do think that that's something worth thinking about. You know, if this were a different panel, we could no doubt spend hours on theories of the unitary executive. But one of the things that I like about the idea of a constitutional convention is that we wouldn't have to spend a single minute on what people were thinking in 1787, but rather talk about, given the realities of 2023, what makes best sense as a way to govern ourselves. And here's where the states have overwhelmingly rejected very important aspects of the 1787 system.
Well, thank you very much. That will have to be the last word on this exciting panel. So thank you. Let's give them a hand.
Yes, thank you to our panelists and especially to our moderator, Judge Bumate. Okay, it is time for lunch, but let me give you some instructions. So lunch will be out in that foyer where you guys were before. We have two breakout sessions. You will take your lunch to the breakout sessions. That's where we have tables set up for you to sit down and eat. You get to choose between, let me make sure I get the name right here. In A, which is the room just to this side, we have an introduction to the lawyers division. So that's in breakout room A, which if you come out these doors, it'll be right over there on your right. So you can grab your lunch, go in that way. And then in room B, which is on this side, we have becoming an academic. So B is becoming an academic. And there are signs outside of each of those in case you forget, but please grab your lunch and try to head in an orderly fashion into those rooms so we can get started. Thank you, everyone.